I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, it's Midday on Theater. My guest is the new artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage. Stephanie Ibarra took the reins of Maryland's largest professional theater last fall. An accomplished producer with more than 20 years of experience in New York and elsewhere, she is one of the country's most high-profile Latinx theater professionals. Stephanie Ibarra will announce today the plays that she and her team have chosen to present at Baltimore Center Stage next season, and we'll talk about her vision for making theater that resonates locally while advancing Center Stage's international reputation. We'll be joined in our conversation by Midday's theater critic J. Wynn Russick, who will also review Flyin' West, the new production at Baltimore's Arena Players. Midday on Theater starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for Midday. Before we begin today, we note the passing of Harry Hughes, who served two terms as governor of Maryland from 1979 to 1987. When he won the 1978 Democratic primary for governor, it was considered one of the great political upsets in Maryland history. In remembering Mr. Hughes, Senate President Mike Miller noted Hughes's commitment to the environment and the Chesapeake Bay, and he called him a great and courageous leader. Harry Hughes died yesterday at his home in Denton. He was 92 years old. So today on our program, it's Midday on Theater. Last August, Baltimore Center Stage announced the appointment of Stephanie Ibarra as its new artistic director. She succeeded Kwame Kwe Arma, who left to become the artistic director of the Young Vic Theater in London. Stephanie Ibarra came to Baltimore after 6 years as the director of special artistic projects at the Public Theater in New York, where she oversaw its popular public forum programs and led the theater's mobile unit on a first-of-its-kind national tour. She's also a co-leader of the Women's Project Theater Producers Lab, and she's the curator and casting director of the Cruzando Fronteras, or Crossing Borders Festival, at the Two River Theater in New Jersey. That festival features the work of Latinx theater artists. Stephanie Ibarra is, in fact, one of the first Latinx theater artists to lead a major American regional theater. Today, Baltimore Center Stage is announcing the plays it will present next season. Our theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me here in Studio A with Stephanie Ibarra to talk about her plans for next year and beyond. You are welcome to join our conversation as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at Midday WYPR. And you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Stephanie, it's really great to meet you.
Likewise. It's so good to be here.
Welcome to town.
Thank you.
And Judy, welcome back.
Thank you. And I reiterate that welcome to Stephanie.
It's interesting to me that your orientation and your experience is as a producer, whereas the last couple of artistic directors of this particular theater, Kwame and Irene Lewis, who was here for a long, long time, both directors, Kwame an actor, a playwright himself. Your orientation as a producer, first of all, explain to folks outside of the theater universe what the difference between a producer and a director is, and how that experience has informed your approach to this new gig.
Well, as an artistic producer, I wear... many hats. My expertise is in being a generalist. So it's part dramaturgy, part artistic facilitator, part business brain, and all of that converges into one facilitative artist, as I like to call myself. And I am thrilled with, of course, my appointment, but, you know, down our neighbors in D.C., Woolly Mammoth, the new artistic director, Maria Guayanas, Jacob Bedrone, who is the new artistic director at Long Wharf, and John Diaz, who is the artistic director at Two River Theater Company, we all sort of identify as variations on a producing artist. So I do everything a director does except direct, as an artistic director, but I'm really thrilled that we're sort of becoming more popular in the
I think you sort of have a 30,000 feet view in a way. I mean, a director, obviously, you know, it's like I used to be a conductor of classical choral music and opera and stuff. And, you know, you get into a score and you sort of look at it from the inside out. A director looks at a text and gets into it from the inside out. But you're looking at it from the outside in, which can be a very it's a different orientation and a really productive one, I can imagine.
Absolutely. When people always ask me if I live more on the art side or more on the business side, and I'm at my happiest when I am smack in the middle and sort of traversing both. Because I actually don't believe that there is a side. That's a false sort of paradigm. And I love to traverse the rehearsal room as much as I love traversing the sort of the office and the boardroom.
Yeah.
If I can follow up on that a little bit, I've heard you call yourself a creative producer, which is a little different. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, you know, I will use creative or artistic to modify producer because, mostly because in Broadway lingo, a producer can mean investor.
Well, and I should tell our listeners, if they are not watching this online, that Stephanie is not wearing an old fedora and she doesn't have a big cigar sticking in her mouth, which is, I think, what we think of Broadway producers.
Right. Yet. I don't have a cigar yet.
You took the fedora off before you came into the studio.
That's right. Yeah, so it is just my way of signaling to folks who I'm working with that I am deeply invested in the creative process, in the artistic process, and I identify as an artistic collaborator, the same way you would have a director and design team and actors and playwright. I feel very much as a part of that process.
And of course, the word creative means a whole lot of things. I mean, it's a creative act to hire a director, to pick a play, to hire an actor to do a certain role. You know, and it's interesting because the models for leadership of regional theaters and even New York theaters have varied over the years. Sometimes there's consortiums, you know, four or five people make decisions. Sometimes the artistic director is also the executive director. You know, she is both the financial, the person with ultimate fiduciary responsibility as well as artistic responsibility. You have a collaborator in the executive director of Center Stage, Michael Ross, who preceded you. He's been here. This is his second tour of duty, actually. How's that dynamic? How do you see the potential for that dynamic being really helpful?
Well, like so many of these structures, the success of that model is dependent a lot on the personalities of the individuals who occupy the roles. And I feel like the luckiest artistic director in the American theater in that I have Michael Ross as my partner. We won't talk about how much he and I have spent, how much time we've spent laughing in our respective offices.
That's but right. I think this is art. It's supposed to be serious. Don't have too good a time. You'll lose your license.
It feels amazing to walk into a space and have a partner who is so deeply entrenched and rooted in the history of the organization and comes with so much experience locally and nationally. And on top of that, to have that person be hilarious is just a gift. It's just a gift. And he's been so supportive of me and all of my shenanigans since I got here.
And Michael is hilarious. Yeah. I can you know, second that emotion. Of course, most of the time when we're together, he's just laughing at me, but that's a whole different story.
So, Stephanie, you've been at Center Stage for a few months now, and I wonder what you see as the very best thing about the theater. We were talking in the green room about it having actually an international reputation. And I'd also like to know what you feel isn't quite working the way you'd like it to be, what you'd like to change.
Well, I think that one of Center Stage's biggest assets is its reputation locally, nationally, internationally. And it was a big draw for me in pulling me away from New York and my beloved public theater. It was a no-brainer to come and join the Center Stage family. And I think that I was writing the email to the staff this morning and to the board, you know, sort of sending out the official press release of our season announcement and found myself overwhelmed by overcome with sort of emotion and elation because there is so much talent packed into that organization. So it's no wonder it carries the sort of reputation it has. And in terms of things I would love to keep going on and keep poking at, I really, you know, I'm excited to explore the ways that Center Stage can go even further in activating community conversations and civic conversations and really centering civic life more broadly and putting that in the same sentence as artistic life.
Of course, New York is New York, and it's kind of sui generis. It's long been the epicenter of theater. Interestingly, 10, 15 years ago, Washington, D.C. became the second most prolific theater town in America behind Chicago. It used to be Chicago, then Washington, and then they flipped. So this region, the Baltimore-Washington area, is quite vibrant. But how do you see, coming from New York and coming from the Public, which is a major American institution in the theater, how do you see the role of regional theater companies like Center Stage, like Woolly Mammoth in D.C., like, you know, the theaters that are really doing important work, but they ain't on Broadway?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I could probably talk for hours about the complexities and nuances within that sort of that conversation. The relatively brief answer is, from where I sit, you know, I think that the American theater is at its best when there is a kind of fluidity and reciprocity happening, an exchange that is happening between regions. And that can be between New York and the regional theaters writ large, but also between different regions around the country. You know, having been in New York for the last decade, working on classics and new plays, it is a fantastic ecology, and it can be very harsh. It can be brutal. So I think there is a large role to play for the regional theaters in just providing a really nurturing and safe space for artists to just let it rip, to explore until their heart's content.
So it's brutal and harsh for the actors, the directors, the producers, the theater companies themselves, for the audiences. What is it? What's brutal and harsh about it?
Well, there's a lot of spotlight on New York, and that is a blessing and a curse. You know, it is the most visible platform we have as an art form. And that means that there's a lot more competition in New York. And also the critical landscape can be, you can make or break a person's career given any one review, and which is not the healthiest in my opinion, but that is the reality.
Absolutely.
Well, and I do think you're going to find Baltimore a very warm and welcoming community for theater artists. That's certainly been the experience that I've had covering it over the years. I'd like to go back to what you were saying about civic engagement. You ran the Public Theater's mobile unit, and Baltimore Center Stage also has a mobile unit. I saw its production of Antigone at one of the schools last week. Do you have plans for other civic engagement programs expanding beyond that mobile unit? Do you have dreams?
Absolutely. It's hard for me to imagine anymore a play or a season or a conversation on stage that doesn't want to be amplified and continued and expanded in some way off stage. And next season, I think we'll see a big uptick in the way Center Stage is engaging, not just via the mobile unit, but I think via many other kinds of activities that will come to fruition over the course of the next 12 to 18 months.
And you're talking, I assume, not just about getting other people into the theater, into the audience, but getting the theater to other audiences.
100%.
Diversity is something that you're very committed to. You are part of a group called the Artists Anti-Racism Coalition. Some of the folks you mentioned a few minutes ago, Jacob Perron, David Roberts, Roberta Pierre, you're working to diversify not just audiences, but theater companies, artists, directors, playwrights, etc. By the way, you'll be the third person I've asked this today. Is the pronunciation of the term Latinx or Latinx?
I think it can go either way. I've said it both ways. I tend to say Latinx because I'm from Texas, and so I just drawl.
All right. So far there's two Latinxes and one Latinx. Mm-hmm. So I'll start joining the majority. But is it a matter of attracting audiences with people of color and people of, you know, marginalized communities because the work is about those communities? Or is it also a matter of getting the sort of standard canon, you know, the Eurocentric canon, presented in a way that resonates with communities, whether they're marginalized or not?
It's all of the above and more. When my friends and I started the Artist Anti-Racist Coalition, we were looking at not just the sort of value proposition of, you know, new audiences as a reason for hiring and telling the stories of, by, for people of color, but also actually recognizing that those decisions we make, the curatorial decisions we make, translate into jobs. They're hiring and employment decisions, and they represent numbers of dollars that go into the pockets of artists of color. And there is a ripple effect. So there is a very practical reason for wanting to diversify our storytellers. We don't want to perpetuate the wage gap. We don't want to perpetuate systemic exclusion. And we don't want to perpetuate the co-opting of the lives of people of color. But I also think that in order for our art form and for our organizations to remain relevant, we must figure out a way to remove as many barriers as possible, whether they're financial or cultural or psychological.
Stephanie Ibarra is the artistic director at Baltimore Center Stage. Midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick has covered the regional theater scene for more than probably about 40 years for the Baltimore Sun and now for Midday. Baltimore Center Stage has announced its season for next year. We'll talk with Stephanie Ibarra about what's in store at that institution that was long ago designated the State Theater of Maryland on the other side of this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our show, a conversation about the notion of beauty in the arts. Jimmy Rouse is a local artist who's about to open a new show at the Creative Alliance here in Baltimore. Juliet Marchari Alexander is the director of the Walters Art Museum. And Dr. Anjan Chatterjee is a neurologist at the University of Pennsylvania who studies how our brains respond to beauty and how we come to define what it is we think is beautiful. Plus, we'll take a look at an initiative at Baltimore's other equity theater, the Everyman Theater. They have a salon series that features work by women playwrights. We'll meet one of them, Colleen Sinnott Jennings, and that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday on the Arts. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Theater, and a little later, Midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review the new show at Baltimore's Arena Players. Judy joins me here in Studio A, along with Stephanie Ibarra. She's the recently appointed artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage. You are welcome to join us, too. Our number at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, which you are cordially required to do, @TomHallWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, because we're streaming it live from Studio A.
So, Stephanie, we are very excited to be announcing the new season at Baltimore Center Stage. And new is the key word here, because with the possible exception of Euripides, these playwrights are, many of them, new to me, and certainly, I believe, all new to Baltimore Center Stage. In addition to Euripides, probably the only writer with a familiar name to a broader audience is Chiara Alegría Hudes, who wrote the book for the musical In the Heights. You were Associate Managing Director of New Play Development at Yale Rep and Yale School of Drama. Is part of your mission to introduce Baltimore Center Stage audiences to new playwrights?
Absolutely. I think that while these writers and perhaps and their plays are new to Baltimore, specifically, there is so much to be familiar with inside of the stories. I think inside of each of these pieces, we are going to find deeply familiar and resonant stories and themes and ideas, even if the titles themselves and the names of the playwrights feel a bit new.
And along with the familiar, this is a very diverse season. The one thing I see in common besides the newness is a little bit of classical Greek flavor, at least at the start and at the finish, Euripides at the end. In the beginning, the season opens with a musical called Miss You Like Hell. This is a musical by Erin McCone and Pulitzer Prize winner Chiara Alegria Houdis. The show is partly based on the Odyssey. That's the little bit of Greek flavor. In this case, as I understand it, a mother and a daughter take a cross-country road trip. The daughter is a U.S. citizen. The mother is an immigrant. The trip comes immediately prior to the mother's immigration hearing. It has a rock score. I brought a sample from the production that was done at the Public Theater.
But I remember Saturdays or weekend visit, the way she scooped me in her arms. Time seemed infinite. Our silly little dances and how we'd sway, the nonsense rhymes we'd love to say. I buried my face into her skin and breathed her in. Can it happen again?
That was the song Sundays from the Public Theater's production of Miss You Like Hell. Stephanie, Miss You Like Hell will introduce you, or at least your taste, to Baltimore audiences. What made you choose this show as your opener?
Well, in addition to the fact that I just didn't get enough of it when I was at the Public with that production, I think that it's one of the more timely conversations we could be having. Certainly, the story of an undocumented mother and her child is feeling pretty resonant these days. And I also, artistically, this play, by virtue of the fact that it's a musical, so formally it is asking and begging for the audience's imagination to get in there and fill in some blanks. But also this particular script, I think in part because it does have its roots in the, you know, in the ancient Greeks, it's really being driven a lot by the performers themselves. And so you won't see a lot of stuff on stage. You're going to see some really dynamic performances. I should also say that this is not the only production of Miss You Like Hell that will happen next season in Maryland. The Olney Theater Center will also do a production of Miss You Like Hell in January, I think, or in the winter. And what's been incredible is we've come together with the Olney to collaborate on a season-long series of civic conversations and activities to help really amplify the themes and ideas in this play and to help raise awareness around immigration issues.
Programming for a person in your position is so incredible. It's like it's the ball game, isn't it? I mean, if you do rotten productions of great plays, you can get by. But if you do great productions of rotten plays, it's going to be a disaster. This is the first. When we're talking about this, is your first play. You're here now, and you're overseeing a season that was chosen by somebody else, right? So this is the first season that you've chosen. In New York, it's amazing to me the number of old plays that are just being resuscitated. I mean, when you look at what's coming up in the next year or two, it's plays like or musicals, Oklahoma, you know, Music Man, Kiss Me, Kate. So you're taking a different tack. I mean, obviously, there are folks on Broadway who think that that's at least one way of cashing in some chips. But how is it that what are you going to need to do, and what are audiences going to need to do to be receptive to stuff that they may not have ever heard of?
That's a great question. I hope that audiences will trust Baltimore Center Stage enough to show up the first time. And I think if you just show up and sit in the audience, we're going to tell you a great story. That I can promise. And I think in terms of just where I would ask audiences to meet us is the idea that even though these plays are new, they are all rooted in a very deep storytelling tradition inside the theater. As you said, we are going all the way back to the birthplace of theater and democracy, to the ancient Greeks. And so every single one of these plays is being told with a kind of hyper theatrical style that I think will feel very familiar and exciting.
All right, so that's the first one that'll open next season. It's called Miss You Like Hell. The next is Thoughts of a Colored Man on a Day When the Sun Set Too Early.
This is another play by a new playwright, Kenan Scott II, at least new to me. It's interesting also because it will be the directorial debut of a Broadway actor, Taye Diggs. He's also done a good bit of TV work. Center Stage's production is a co-production with Syracuse Stage. And this sounds like one of these shows that has an unusual way in. As I understand it, it uses music and movement and poetry to cast light on black men from all walks of life and to defy stereotypes. That comes to Center Stage in October. What can you tell us about this new name, Kenan Scott II, the playwright?
Kenan is an incredible new voice on the American theater scene, and he's based in New York now. He went to college here in Maryland, and he has a deep love of Baltimore. Actually, if I'm getting this correct, he used to perform poetry here and spoken word here in Baltimore, and is so anxious to have his play take place. He has a very specific sort of request and idea for him to have this story told in this city, in this community.
Speaking of new plays, the current play at Center Stage is a play by Paula Vogel, who's a good friend of Judy's. We just saw it, Linnell and I just saw it last night. It's called Indecent. It is terrific. It's a new play about an old play. That's all I'll say. But I'll also say that it's one of the most wonderful nights in the theater we've ever spent. Before we go on and talk about some of the other plays, let's go to the phones to Sean in Bolton Hill. Sean, welcome to Midday with Stephanie Ibarra.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
So what's on your mind? Welcome.
So I'm a local actor. I also drive Lyft, and I just wanted to welcome Miss Ibarra to Smaltimore and just share a story of how small Smaltimore really is. So I was just driving the executive director of the Maryland State Arts Council, and he helped me put two and two together that I picked up a gentleman 2 days ago, dropped him off at the Bolt bus stop, and I found out that I think he's your husband, Jed.
Oh, my gosh. He's my partner.
Sorry about that. Yes.
Oh, yeah. He told me about his conversation with you. Absolutely.
That's hilarious.
Wow.
And I do have a quick question, too.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, as a local actor, I'm just seeing your stance on, using local talent. There's been times I've heard that, if you're a Baltimore actor, you don't quite get cast at Center Stage. But maybe could you share maybe your thoughts on how you engage local artists, possibly?
Sure. Well, I've only been here for a few months now, but my hope is to quickly get to know all of the dynamic facets of the local art scene. And I cannot say specifically right now how I'm going to do that. I just know that it's a huge priority to sort of figure out all of the ways we can make sure that we are supporting, that Baltimore Center Stage is supporting the Baltimore arts ecology. And I think that will unfold over the course of the next season or two.
I should mention that in Indecent, Susan Rome and Susan Linsky. Susan Linsky is sort of Washington-based, but they're two local talents who do a terrific job. So back to next year, another play on the schedule coming at the end of November is Men on Boats. What can you tell us about that, Judy? And what can you tell us about that, Stephanie?
Well, it's by a playwright who sounds like a very adventuresome playwright with an original vision. Her name is Jacqueline Backhouse. This show was an off-Broadway hit, and it's based on a true story of a group of male explorers on a river expedition through the Grand Canyon in 1869. Now, in previous productions, all of these men have been played by women. I wanted to know, is that in the script? Is that intentional by the playwright? And is that the way it's going to be done here?
That is intentional. It is Jacqueline's wonderfully subversive take on this particular story. And so the cast will continue to include women and women identifying bodies. Yeah.
And what's the story about?
It is, as Judy said, it is the story of the exploration and the mapping of this river through the Grand Canyon. And it is drawing on the true-ish, you know, diary entries of the explorer John Powell and all of his compatriots.
Yeah, and that's what's fun to me about theater, not being an expert in it, just being a lover of it, you know, because there's stuff that I think, well, the subject matter, I may not like that at all. Like, why would I be interested in a Yiddish play that came to New York in the 1920s? Well, I was, you know, weeping and completely engrossed in it last night, because that's what the play
Indecent is
about. So, you know, you can take these subject matters that may not strike you on its face as being something you'd be interested in, but it turned out to be, you know, incredibly resonant. So the next one is called Where We Stand.
And this is by a playwright named Danetta Lavinia Grays, who is definitely an up-and-comer. This is going to be a major production for her, I believe. Is it a one-person show starring her, perhaps? Or
it's a one-person play, and I'm hopeful that Danetta will step in to perform. But the way we're conceiving this production is that we will rehearse with a couple of performers so that we can hear the story.
Rotate a little bit.
Yeah, so that we can hear the story through multiple vantage points.
The next one's called Richard and Jane and Dick and Sally. I assume they are the offspring of Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. I'm dating myself because it's a movie that, you know, many of our listeners have never heard of.
Yeah, Richard and Jane and Dick and Sally is one of my proudest moments of the season. This is playwright Noah Diaz. This will be his first professional production. He's currently a second-year playwriting student at the Yale School of Drama, studying with my dear friend Terrell Alvin McCraney. And it is a heartbreaking, hilarious play about all of the ways that family goes wrong and right.
And these are actually the characters, but grown up from those 1950s awful children's books. At least I didn't find them interesting back then.
Yeah, CJ and Run.
Yes, exactly. Run. Yeah, right. But I think they're going to be really interesting as adults.
Exactly.
And the last one is the Euripides play that Judy mentioned at the beginning of this part of our conversation, The Bacchae. The Bacchae? The Bacchae. So what can you? I'm going to pour myself a glass of wine here and listen to you talk about this.
Very appropriate, because this is, of course, a play about Dionysus and his female followers, the Bacchae. I wondered which adaptation you're going to be using and what you feel this ancient Greek tragedy has to tell us today.
We haven't selected the adaptation just yet. We're still combing through that material, but I think. This play, this will take place right in the middle of our primary season as a country. And so I'm very interested in
the political primary.
The political primary, yeah. And so I'm very interested in the way that community and communing and shared ideas and shared values tips into, you know, groupthink and the occult. I feel like that is a very resonant idea in our political climate today. But also, the Bacchae is just screaming out for a big party in the theater. And so that's what we're going to do. We're just going to end the season with a big party.
There you go. Why not? As a person who sits in the house during rehearsals or a person who sits in the house during performances, what have you found in your life of theater to be the sort of particular capacity for an experience in the theater to be? Particular, which is to say, it's different than going to a museum or reading a wonderful novel or sitting and listening to the Baltimore Symphony play or watching a dance performance. What does theater do that the other forms don't do as well?
Thornton Wilder, I think, said it best, and I'm going to ruin his quote right now. But Thornton Wilder describes theater as a collective adventure of the mind. And he talks about the socialness of theater, that thing that happens when you get people together in a live space. And so I think that is far and away the sort of biggest gift that theater has to offer people, particularly today in the world of streaming Netflix at home and streaming a podcast right into your ears. I think it's really a gift to give, to hold space for people to come together and witness something together.
Yeah, the communal aspect really matters. It's such a different experience. Like when I was performing regularly as a musician, we would play a dress rehearsal to an empty house on, you know, Thursday afternoon. And then Friday night when there's an audience, it's the same music. We're playing it essentially the same way in the same space, yet there's 1,000 people watching. And it's just a very different thing. It's a much better thing, you know. The fact that we come together to watch theater and to experience it really matters a lot.
Well, and that goes back to the ancient Greeks, too, because theater was a religious event, a religious experience for them.
Yeah.
And it certainly still is a religious experience for me.
The issue of relevance and resonance to the repertoire and to the way it's presented is so important. I mean, so many of the pieces you're going to be doing next year, you know, relate to literally things ripped out of the headlines. Are there other ways that theater work can be resonant and relevant to individuals and to us as Baltimore, 4 years after Freddie Gray, in the middle of, you know, in the beginning of a presidential primary season, et cetera, et cetera?
I think that the power of storytelling is often underestimated in our society. We are always, every day of our lives, we are either telling some version of our story or we are being told a story, whether it's by the media or by our film and television or by our theater spaces. And I think that next season, the sort of focus on the people telling the stories rather than the stuff telling the stories, if that makes sense, and really being driven by a hyper-theatrical kind of aesthetic, I think is going to hopefully remind us all of our own capacity individually to tell our stories and the stories of our communities.
Well, that sounds very enticing. I have to ask you, looking at the season and when everything is being produced and performed, I spot a 3-month gap sort of in the middle from the end of December to the third week in March. So I'm very curious what's going to go on then.
To be determined. Ooh. To be announced at a later date.
But we should say that it's not that you just, you know, produce 5 plays and call it a day. I mean, there's a lot more going on at Center Stage. I mean, even in the summer, you do camps for children and all that kind of stuff and new playwright stuff. I mean, any new initiatives to talk about for next year?
Well, absolutely. We're going to continue our really robust education programming. We have a family series that we'll announce at a later date that will take place over the course of, you know, different productions over the course of the year. And then, as I said, I think, you know, once, now that we've got this season announcement sort of locked in, we immediately turn our gaze to what are the additional activities that we're going to bring into the theater and host at the theater in order to augment and enhance the conversations we're already having on our stage.
Stephanie Ibarra is the artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage. The current production at BCS, as I mentioned, is Paula Vogel's Indecent. Run, do not walk to see this in production. I thought it was great. Linnell thought it was great. That's all I'm going to say about that. You can catch that production until the 31st of March, and we'll have a link to the announcement of the 2019-20 season on our website, wypr.org/midday. Great to meet you, and break a leg.
Thank you.
Quick break. When we return, Midday on Theater continues with J. Wynn Russick's Weekly Review. We're going to talk about Flyin' West, the current production at Baltimore's Arena Players. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.